for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. After marathon peace talks, leaders announced a ceasefire agreement to halt fighting in Ukraine. The head of the UN says Yemen is collapsing, and an American woman held hostage by ISIS has died. Here for the week's top international stories on the Friday News Roundup, Matthew Lee of the Associated Press, Missy Ryan of the Washington Post, and Peter Bergen of CNN. Throughout the hour, we'll welcome your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Good to see you all. Peter Bergen, talk about this Ukraine ceasefire, how it was negotiated.
Well, it's similar to another negotiation that took place in Minsk in September that didn't hold. I guess the kind of conventional wisdom is that this one is unlikely to hold. It's supposed to go into effect Saturday. It was the subject of many hours of negotiations, but Putin has shown that he's not a reliable interlocutor in the past on this issue, and there isn't much presumption to think that he might be, except with one caveat. You know, the Russian economy is collapsing, or not collapsing, but the ruble has lost 14% of its value in the last year. The sanctions are hurting. The price of energy is affecting the Russian economy. Another round of sanctions, I think, would damage the Russian economy in a serious manner and bring pressure to bear on him.
Matthew Lee, what are the main conditions of a ceasefire?
Well, the first is obviously to cease firing. That is supposed to take effect Saturday night, Sunday. And then there is supposed to be a withdrawal of heavy weapons and foreign troops. Then there is supposed to be the beginning of a political process that will hopefully, although I don't think realistically, resolve the issues in the eastern part of Ukraine. This is an agreement that I think, not to be too cynical about it, is almost certainly bound to fail, because already we're seeing signs that what was agreed wasn't really agreed to. For one, the Europeans and the Ukrainians in particular, backed by the United States, who were not, the U.S. wasn't part of this negotiation, but they really wanted an immediate return to full control for the Ukrainian border to Kiev, the Ukrainian-Russian border. Under this agreement, that is not going to happen until the end of this year. The reason that's important is because the Russians are accused of moving troops and tanks and heavy heavy equipment over that border. Without Ukrainian control of it, that's possibly to be continued. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, to be very quickly, is that there's supposed to be a release of all the prisoners that have been taken by either side. And the Russians today said the prime Ukrainian prisoner that they're holding, who's this fighter pilot accused of killing some Russian journalists, will not be released. This had been a big demand of the Ukrainians, and now allegedly it was agreed to, and now they say no.
Missy Ryan, bound to fail.
Well, I mean, if we look at what happened to the last Minsk agreement in September, it was never truly implemented. And if you look at the statements that the European leaders had coming out of the summit, it really shows the skepticism with which they're approaching this latest agreement, which actually wasn't signed by the heads of state or the most senior officials present at the meeting. It was signed by lower level officials, which sort of suggests that perhaps they wanted to distance themselves. The headline that I thought was very telling was Glimmer of Hope, which were the words that German Chancellor Angela Merkel used to describe her feeling at the conclusion of this marathon negotiation.
She was really right in the middle of this whole thing all the way through, wasn't she?
She was, and as she is with so many of the other major challenges facing Europe, such as the Greek bailout.
Interesting that the World Bank is agreeing to give $2 billion in financial assistance to Ukraine. What will that be used for? How will it be used?
As Peter mentioned, the Russian economy is hurting because of sanctions and the fall of, but it's nowhere near as bad as the Ukrainian economy, which is just in shambles. They're spending millions and millions of dollars a day to keep up this fight in the east. And in the meantime, their industry is down. Their economy is essentially dead. They are in serious need of this money from not only the World Bank but the IMF, from the EU, which doesn't have a lot of money to go around and is dealing with, as Missy just noted, the Greek debt crisis, and the United States. They need money, but they need money from pretty much anyone. And there is a lot of suspicion, and I think probably accurate suspicion, that one of Putin's aims here. Is to have the Ukrainian economy essentially collapse before his does, and then be able to move in and keep a hold of territory that the rebels have won.
I thought it was interesting that President Obama held off on the question of sending arms to Ukraine after he had met with Chancellor Merkel on Monday, Peter.
Yeah, and there seems to be some sort of split in the administration, with perhaps the new defense secretary, Ash Carter, being, at least in theory, perhaps more open to this, and others in the administration kind of being more skeptical. And at the end of the day, President Obama hasn't made a decision. We don't know what that decision will be.
In the end, it's fascinating to me that at the same time Russia is dealing with all this on Ukraine, he's seeking closer ties with North Korea, Missy.
Well, I mean, Russia is in some ways feeling more and more isolated at the moment, and it's not surprising that they would reach out to others when it looks like, you know, the Cold War is over, but in some way there's a mini freeze going on right now. Between Russia and the West, and, you know, they do want to have allies.
Missy, the only American woman known to have been held by ISIS is dead. Do we know how she died?
Well, ISIS claimed that she was killed in a Jordanian airstrike, which, of course, the government of Jordan denies. They were furious in the aftermath of the execution of their pilot, Moaz al-Kasasba. And the Pentagon says that they are certain that she was not killed by a coalition airstrike, but they also say they don't know exactly when and how she was killed.
How can they be certain she wasn't killed in that airstrike?
They say that the facility that was where she was killed, allegedly killed, which was a weapons depot, I believe, had been under surveillance. And, of course, that's what they do from the sky, is try to ensure that there aren't civilians, and especially not these American hostages, which, you know, have been a huge priority for the Obama administration. President Obama even launched at least one raid to rescue Kayla Mueller and other hostages. They try to make sure that they're not going to be in the facilities that are targeted for bombing. But, of course, I mean, this reflects the difficulty of conducting this military operation from arm's length, which is that without the spotters on the ground or the military air officials who would be able to tell you exactly where to target your airstrikes, it's not 100% in any of these cases.
Even her boyfriend tried to rescue her, Peter.
Yeah, this is a Syrian who was captured with her when ISIS kidnapped them. And he was imprisoned by ISIS for about a month. This is according to a source close to the family. When he got out, he went back with a fake marriage certificate and basically went into this ISIS facility saying that he was married to her. Of course, that wasn't true, and nothing came of it. But he, you know, at considerable risk, I think he went back to try and get her out. But on the issue of, is this true that she was killed in the building? I mean, to me, the pictures that ISIS released of this building, which had been theoretically bombed by the Jordanian Air Force, I mean, if you drop a bomb on a building, it doesn't basically stand up in the way it did in this picture. The pictures themselves that ISIS released with this claim didn't make sense.
Didn't make sense.
Well, it didn't. Look, the picture shows a building which is basically pretty much standing up. If you've dropped a bomb on it, it would just disappear. It looked like a building that had taken some small arms fire and maybe an artillery round or two, not a building that had been destroyed by the Jordanian Air Force.
Now ISIS is said to be close to a military base in Iraq that houses hundreds of U.S. advisors.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there was an assault on the base. It was repelled, but clearly it's a very worrying development, not just for the Iraqis, but for the U.S. as well, because of the personnel who are stationed there. So this is a this is an issue that is not going away. There may be small gains or medium-sized gains being made against ISIS by the Kurds, but in Iraq proper, I think that it's a much mixed. The story is far more mixed.
Yeah, I think it also just shows the tenacity of the Islamic State and the fighters that they've been able to recruit, and in some ways that they have a lot more zeal than the Iraqi army recruits who, to be fair, have really suffered from not only poor leadership, but often they're not equipped properly. They don't get the ammunition they need. Their leaders have walked off, their bases at many times. And Ain al-Assad, which is the base where this took place in Anbar, is not the first military base in Anbar that has been either attacked or overrun.
Missy Ryan, she's Pentagon reporter for The Washington Post. Short break here. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pajamagram Company, offering hoodie footy pajamas in gift packaging, available in solids and Valentine's Day prints, delivered overnight and for Valentine's Day at pajamagram.com. From Citrix, with GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring HD video conferencing, screen sharing, and meeting recording capabilities. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
And welcome back to the International Hour of our Friday News Roundup, this week with Matthew Lee. He's diplomatic writer for the Associated Press. Missy Ryan is Pentagon reporter for The Washington Post. Peter Bergen is CNN's national security analyst. He's also at the International Security Program at New America and author of Manhunt, the 10-year search for bin Laden from 9/11 to Abbottabad. And let's talk now about Greece and what's happening there, Matthew. Eurozone finance ministers met with Greek officials to talk about that debt. I mean, they seem to be on two different tracks here.
That's charitable. Two different planets might be might be a little bit more accurate. Yeah, the election last month of the of this far left party, far left government in Greece, has really thrown a wrench into what I think everybody had hoped was going to be a very smooth part of a European economic recovery. The demands that they are making to, refinance, to redo the bailout that they were offered, have really set the wealthier members of the European Union against each other. With the Germans, the richest, being completely opposed to this. What's kind of interesting, though, is that it goes up and down. It's very much like a roller coaster. One day, it's the Greeks are demanding new terms, and the Germans are saying no, and then markets go crazy. And then the next day, they soften their rhetoric a little bit, and the markets calm down again. A short-term resolution, I don't think, is...
But what kind of leverage does Greece have in trying to renegotiate this deal, Missy?
I think the leverage that Greece has is that there are lots of people in Europe who want to see the single currency, the Eurozone, remain intact. And Greece leaving or dropping the single currency would be, in some ways, you know, it would reflect on the whole experiment over these many years. And it may be a real possibility now, and maybe it would be best for Greece. I think lots of Greeks have, you know, certainly asked themselves that question. And it really does underscore the difficulty of balancing these varied fiscal and political agendas, sometimes conflicting between this diverse set of states that is in the Eurozone.
Peter.
Yeah, I mean, I think this goes through like a long historical resentment that particularly the Germans have had about the countries like Greece and Spain that are part of the EU, but are, you know, just their economies are not doing very well. And even pretty educated Germans who like the idea of the EU in theory object to the idea that they as German taxpayers are somehow subsidizing countries that aren't pulling their weight like Greece. I don't think that equation is going to change anytime soon. This didn't start with this particular round of discussions. I mean, this has been going on for years, arguably since the Great Recession of 2009, where these kinds of pressures have been building up.
You know, it's funny what you just mentioned, though, the former Swedish foreign minister, Carl Bildt, I believe is a Swede, but after the election of this new prime minister and new government, said that this is the first time that a European government, a European political party has come to power by campaigning to raise the taxes of everyone else in Europe except for Greece. And I think that there really is, as Peter said, this big, enormous resentment about among the wealthier EU countries as to why should they have to come to the rescue time and time again of a country that has really had unsound fiscal policies for decades.
And on the other hand, apparently Angela Merkel is known as the austerity queen by many Greeks. So it's on both sides.
All right. And Missy Ryan Ashton Carter had a pretty swift and overwhelming confirmation as Secretary of Defense this week.
Yep, he was confirmed yesterday officially. His confirmation hearing went very smoothly. He was shown respect by the senators who were listening to him. He also exhibited clear willingness to question the policies of President Obama, and that was music to the Senate Armed Services Committee's ears. I think that it's going to be a really interesting period with Ashton Carter, head of the Pentagon. He's a physicist. He's a medieval historian. He has held senior policy and sort of procurement management jobs at the Pentagon. And he has a reputation for having a very forceful personality. And I think the combination of Ash Carter and General Martin Dempsey, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who has become increasingly close with the White House, to have them together in those National Security Council meetings, I think will be a really interesting dynamic and could shake things up.
What did he say about boots on the ground as far as ISIS or as far as Ukraine?
He has expressed willingness to consider expanding military activities, both in when it comes to ISIS, when it comes to the current drawdown plan in Afghanistan, and when it comes to Ukraine. So, you know, I mean, it doesn't mean that he would actually support things at the end of the day, but he's leaving the door open.
But do you think he would have said those things without having first been told by the White House that he could say those things?
Well, I would imagine that his testimony or the basic positions had been cleared with the White House prior to the confirmation hearing. But I think, you know, frankly, I think that the White House knows who they're getting in Ashton Carter, and he's been around for a long time. He's actually quite close to some of the people in Obama's most close coterie of advisors. And, you know, I think that they are willing to listen, at least. We'll see.
Interesting.
I think there's one thing to say. You know, in his confirmation hearing, he said he thought that it was a good idea, or it might be, he was open to the idea of sending arms to Ukraine. It appears that there was some kind of very choreographed thing going on. When the administration publicly floats arming, you have their nominee for the Pentagon chief saying that he's in favor of it. And immediately after that, we saw a week of really diplomatic flurry that ended with this Minsk agreement. Now, I don't know if you can say that you can give the administration credit for perhaps getting Putin's attention with the idea of arming Ukraine, but certainly Ash Carter's comments in his hearing played into that.
Let's talk about Yemen. Yesterday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon warned that Yemen is collapsing before our eyes. What's going on, Peter?
I think Yemen's been collapsing for a long time. I mean, this is the poorest country in the Arab world. It is running out of water. It is running out of oil. It has arguably three different civil wars going on simultaneously. The fact that the Houthis have taken over is deeply surprising. And Missy's been to Yemen, so has Matthew, and so have I. And, you know, they're a very marginal group in Yemeni society. And the fact that they were able to take the capital and basically take the U.S. embassy is pretty extraordinary. And is that, you know, the big question is, can we conduct our counterterrorism campaign without an embassy? And I think the answer is yes, to some degree, because you can do it from ships and from Djibouti and other places, but it's still not as effective. And the other big question is, does this help al-Qaeda in Yemen or not? Because on one level, the Houthis are very against al-Qaeda, and they will be quite willing to fight them. On the other hand, al-Qaeda can then say, hey, we're your protectors. The majority Sunni population, you may not love us, but we're the tough guys on the block. And I think the latter is relatively likely to happen, in the sense that the Sunni population is going to feel like we need some protection from these guys.
Missy,
I would just say that it's been happening for a while. This isn't a huge surprise that there's been the collapse of the government. However, I think it's hugely tragic because Yemen was once one of the few success stories that people in this country pointed to from the Arab Spring. They had a relatively orderly transition of power. There was a national dialogue process that was seen as very inclusive. And that's really fallen apart. And
How did it fall apart? What happened?
There's, you know, Yemen, it's hard to know where to begin with the list of challenges that you have in Yemen. Just as Peter said, it's the Arab world's poorest country. It's a deeply fractured society in terms of geography, tribes, different religious and ethnic sects. At the same time, you have a hugely high rate of illiteracy, joblessness. And frankly, the Western interests in Yemen have mostly been, as they've been seen from the West, limited to counterterrorism for a long time. And I think that you know, lack of, you know, hands-on development and governance on a larger scale, you know, really has helped Yemen sort of deteriorate. And now it's just reached a crisis point and people are sort of waking up.
And looming over everything is Iran. The Houthis are linked with Iran, Shia group linked with Shia Iran. And, you know, a lot of people see this as part of Iran's newfound as Iran trying to expand its influence, and I think it's hard to argue with that. They now have the Iranians now have, because the Houthis are in power at least at the moment, a foothold. So, you know, I think that the great concerns among the Gulf countries, the Arab, the Sunni countries in the Gulf about the influence that Iran is playing, not just there, but also in countries like Bahrain. It's a serious concern. And all this takes place against the backdrop of the nuclear negotiations that are going on with the Iranians.
Do any of you hear anything to the effect that Prime Minister Netanyahu may change his thinking about testifying before a joint session of Congress? Reuters had reported that there are actually two speeches, one before AIPAC and one before a joint session of Congress, whether he will narrow that down to one speech before AIPAC is the question?
I highly doubt it.
You do?
Netanyahu sees these nuclear talks and the possibility of a deal that comes from them as deadly for his country. I can't see, and he has shown no, personally shown no sign that he is going to back down. In fact, he just gave a speech or made some comments the day that Kayla Mueller's death was announced, saying he's coming, and then he doubled down on that, going on to Twitter saying, you know, I'm coming, like it or not.
Interesting. And one last question on Yemen. Is it on the brink of civil war?
I mean, I think there's been a series of civil wars that have been going on there for decades, and they kind of ebb and flow. There's a southern secessionist movement. There's the Houthis. There are tribal disputes. By the way, this is the most heavily armed per capita nation in the world. If you have a tribal dispute, you settle it with artillery. You don't settle it with small arms. I mean, this is a it's a chaotic place, a wonderful place. It's a beautiful place. The Yemenis are great people, but they have very serious problems.
So is the West going to step in to do anything?
I have heard no one even suggest that there would be a more robust military response from Western countries. The most pressing question on the mind of officials in the U.S. government who think about counterterrorism is how do they continue this CT counterterrorism campaign, the drone campaign, and then the special operations training program that they've had for many years now in Yemen. And as my colleague Greg Miller has reported, there's been already a dramatic reduction in the CIA presence in Yemen. There continue to be some special operations, U.S. special operations forces outside of the capital, Sana'a. But it's an open question. Just yesterday, al-Qaeda attacked a Yemeni military base in the south of the country. So obviously, there's lots going on all across the country. And the United States has really prioritized fighting against AQAP because they've struck the West and they intend to do so again. But how you can do it without a local partner is a good question.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And as journalist, I want to ask you about Brian Williams. I know, Peter Bergen, you've written, you've reported on especially this claim about his being with SEAL Team 6.
Yeah, he has claimed, not only on the David Letterman show, but I think much more importantly, on his own news show, that he went into Baghdad with SEAL Team 6. Now, any journalist and the group here knows that is, on the face of it, extraordinarily unlikely. I talked to people at the Special Operations Command. They basically said, and they rarely comment officially on anything, they said this just did not happen. I've talked to people in the U.S. Navy SEAL community. They say there's no reason to believe any of this. And I think it's a big problem because this is one of these things that is either not true or true. I mean, he either went in with SEAL Team 6 or he didn't. It's not. And I think it's a big problem for him.
What do you make of what's going on here? He's been suspended without pay for 6 months. There are not only questions about SEAL Team 6, but Hurricane Katrina, other reporting and embedding himself in the news. What do you make of this, Matthew?
Well, I frankly don't know. It seems surprising that someone, if all of this is true, that someone has embellished or, at the worst, just lied about that kind of thing, because as journalists, we all know that the most important thing that we have, our most important quality, is credibility. And if you if it is determined that you are incredible or uncredible, then I don't know that you do anyone a service. You certainly don't do the profession a service. But I don't know the details of this case, so I can't really comment on it.
And for me, the question is why? Why would someone with this prominence, with this visibility, with this kind of income do something like this, Missy?
It's very puzzling, and if it does end his career, it will be a very sad way for someone who has been a trusted voice and trusted figure for many Americans to go out that way. I think maybe it does raise questions about the blurring of the lines between journalism and celebrity, and also the pressure that many people in the public eye are under, including in a very competitive, increasingly financially strained media environment, to make themselves more prominent, to, you know, potentially puff themselves up. Or,
you know, you wonder whether a company like NBC is encouraging its anchors to get out there and be more public, and in the process, that's what happens. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, it's time to open the phones. We'll take your comments, questions. I look forward to hearing from you.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Pajamagram Company, offering hoodie footy pajamas in gift packaging, available in solids and Valentine's Day prints, delivered overnight and for Valentine's Day at pajamagram.com. From Carbonite, providing secure backup and recovery for businesses and homes. Since 2005, Carbonite has backed up more than 500 billion files, from email servers to family photos. Learn more at carbonite.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
The Super Bass-O-Matic 76. Yes, fish eaters, the days of troublesome scaling, cutting, and gutting are over.
Saturday Night Live is celebrating its 40th anniversary with a live special Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we listen to interviews with Dan Aykroyd, Will Ferrell, and other SNL alum. Join us.
Welcome back to the International Hour of the Friday News Roundup. Here's an email from Kelly in Dallas, who says, which is more damaging to Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, canceling his end run around the president of the U.S., or speaking before Congress and fraying the alliance between Israel and America? What do you think, Matt?
Which is worse for him?
Yeah.
Politically at home? I mean, I think there's
Which is more damaging to him?
I think more damaging to him and to what he believes as Israel's interest and survival would be canceling the speech and not coming.
I agree with him. He's under pressure from some quarters at home also not to come, just
exactly,
because people are worried about the relationship with the United States. And then there's been a number of politicians here who have said that they won't attend, or just sort of said that they don't think it's a good idea for him to come and snub the president this way. But he's described it as something he needs to do to confront this existential threat that his country faces. He obviously places that far above the politics of it.
Can I add something here, which is, you know, I've been told by people in the Afghan government that President Ghani and Chief Executive Officer Dr. Abdullah were going to come for their first official visit to the United States right at the time of Netanyahu is here. And they basically have delayed the visit because, and this is why, you know, Congress does not conduct foreign policy. The executive does. Nobody in Congress knew this was happening or had. So, you know, there are other calculations, and this thing did intervene in a way which I think was, you know, not good.
All right. Let's go to Windsor, Ontario. Hi there, Steve. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Diane, my question or my comment is the problem that's going on between Ukraine and Russia. I believe the problem that's going on, that the United States started that problem. Now, the reason why I say that, Diane, is I remember back between Obama and Putin at the United Nations over Syria. Nothing could be done over Syria because Putin wouldn't give his support. That was the first issue. The second issue was when Obama demanded Putin give Snowden back to the United States. Putin refused. Then the third issue was when Obama asked Putin if he wanted help with security at the Olympics in Russia. To me, that was a slap in the face to Putin. Putin had said no. Then the United States put their warship out in the Black Sea, which to me was antagonizing Putin. Then all of a sudden, when the demonstration takes place in Independence Square, Senator John McCain happened to be there with another senator, cheering the people on.
All right, sir. You've raised a number of issues. Peter.
Well, I mean, I think the dispute between the United States and Russia goes back quite a long way. You could make the argument that it begins with the expansion of NATO into Eastern Europe. I mean, that sort of, from the Russians' point of view, that was very threatening to them. So, I mean, the caller enumerated a whole series. I mean, there was going to be this sort of reset with Russia. It just didn't happen because fundamentally the Russians don't trust us and we don't trust them.
I think there is something to the argument that the United States and its European allies did bait Putin to a certain extent because of the NATO expansion and trying to bring former Soviet countries into the Western or the EU sphere. Putin made no bones about the fact that Russia considers Ukraine part of its sphere, and this effort to bring it closer to Europe through trade and political ties was obviously going to be a provocative and controversial thing for him.
All right, to Brownsville, Pennsylvania. James, you're on the air.
And thanks for taking my call. Hey, Peter, this is directed to you, but for the rest of the panel also, your relationship with Special Ops. I'm mystified and puzzled about something. When Jihad John first came on the scene and started cutting Englishmen and Americans and Japanese heads off, Brian Ross from ABC News, oh, we've got to get his eyes, what he looks like, he's left-handed. My question to you, Peter, is, am I watching too many Jack Bauer 24 hours? Why can't we find these people where they're located in Raqqa? Why is it so difficult to send in, like, SEAL Team 6, Delta Force, Rangers, 82nd Airborne people, and get rid of these guys? They burn a man alive.
Yeah. Well, you know, President Obama did authorize quite a risky mission on July 4th of last year to go and rescue James Foley and the other American and British hostages who are being held by Jihadi John, who's a British citizen, and a group of other Brits. And unfortunately, and as he, in fact, President Obama just told BuzzFeed that they'd been moved literally a day or two earlier, the intelligence was dated. But now there is no intelligence clearly if it existed, if there was a sufficient intelligence, there would be an operation again, but it doesn't exist.
We have an email from Carol in Cleveland, who'd like you to comment on the implications of Putin's welcome in Cairo and the nuclear assistance from Russia to Egypt.
I think that's it's a very, very interesting development. It's a great question. Clearly, Putin and his people want to expand Russian influence, and this is a great place to start. The Egyptians, the new government in Egypt, the United States, at least, for example, is still holding up millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in aid over human rights concerns. That would be military assistance, and the administration is looking for a way to get that money to the Egyptians. But there is a kind of a vacuum there. and the Russians are more than happy to fill in. The other interesting thing going on with Egypt now is that you saw yesterday the French president announced this multi-billion-dollar sale of French fighter jets to the Egyptian government. So everyone wants a piece of Egypt.
I think it reflects also the, as Matt suggested, the rockiness of the American relationship with Egypt. My sense is that the White House is just done with Egypt, given the coup and then the human rights abuses, the mass trials, the imprisonment of journalists. I think that they know that they have to have a modicum, some sort of relationship with the Arab world's most populous country and what Egypt means for the region and for Israel. But at the same time, it's so hard to come to terms with accepting this government that, you know, like the Brotherhood government before, it just seems to have overplayed its hand.
All right. Let's see. Roger in Greensboro, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Hi. In the last hour, it was noted that one of your panelists wasn't aware of the labor issue on the West Coast concerning the ports, but I'd like to point out that that is soon to become an international issue when the mega ports in Central America open, and also the widening of the Panama Canal, which is controlled by China, because what we're going to end up doing is we're going to be exporting our safety issues to Central America until those thousands of trucks a day start rolling across the borders into our country. So it's a huge story that will become a major issue in the future.
Indeed, I do agree with that, Roger. Unless we get some settlement of that West Coast port issue.
This is a bit out of my lane of expertise, but yes, I mean, the idea that the port disruptions in ports and the controversy over the canal, the Panama Canal expansion, is something that's going to loom large in not just now, but as we move ahead.
All right, and here's an email from Bill in Clayville, New York. He says, as the father of two officers who've served in both Iraq and Afghanistan, I continue to be horrified at how easily our leaders, few of whom have ever served, send us into war. It's time to open a national debate about bringing back the draft. It could be newly defined to include military and selected civilian work, but we need the debate. Too few Americans have any skin in the game, have no concept of what national service means.
Well, I mean, I think that's true, but bringing back the draft ain't going to happen. There is, General Stanley McChrystal, who was head of Joint Special Operations Command, has been behind an idea where, you know, increasing the idea of having a national service, and that might fly, and I think it's a good idea. But this raises really the question of the authorization for the use of military force, of which on Wednesday, President Obama put forward to Congress, a defined authorization to fight ISIS for 3 years without an enduring troop presence. And, hopefully that will begin to spark some of the debate that the caller wants, because at the end of the Congress doesn't really want to vote on this. It's been kind of reluctant. I mean, at the end of the day, the president is not the person who's supposed to come up with the proposal. It's them. And they've been kind of avoiding it. And I think this is a very good moment for the American people to say, well, do we want an enduring land war in the Middle East?
Right.
Or do we want something more narrow, or whatever we want, whatever it is?
Matthew.
Well, I agree. I think this is the history of AUF. Is a political poison. And as we go up to, as we approach 2016, members of Congress, particularly those who might have higher aspirations to higher office, shall we say, look back at what happened with the earlier ones and say, is this a good idea or not? That said, I do think that Peter's right, that the American people really need to weigh in on this and determine whether they want.
All right, to Carl in Treasure Island, Florida. You're on the air.
Good morning, everyone.
Hi.
I wanted to ask, I get a sense as an average American out here that we are witnessing perhaps something in the Ukraine that we witnessed prior to World War II. I'm thinking of Crimea. I'm thinking of the Sudetenland. Not that I want to compare Putin to Hitler, but I are there similarities and or are there dissimilarities? And the other question I had basically was what was said in the opening comments here of your show, and that was the sanctions. You didn't think that the agreement would hold in Minsk, the second agreement. What would be the downside of imposing greater restrictions on the Russian economy?
Well, I'll just take the first part of that question regarding what you're suggesting is parallels between appeasement prior to the Second World War and, if you want to call it this, appeasement now with Putin. And certainly that would be an argument that some of the proponents of arming the Ukrainians against the Moscow-backed rebels would make. And it's interesting because the Obama administration is now facing increasing pressure from sort of hawkish Democrats and people who former officials, you know, think tank people who are closely tied with the administration, are really a tour de force of the foreign policy elite pressuring them to take this step. And there really is, within the cabinet, as Matt and I were talking before, you know, a lot of support for doing this. But it seems that Obama and his national security advisor, Susan Rice, remain unconvinced.
And that's what we faced with Iraq, as you recall, that the weapons of mass destruction, the voices from the far right saying we have to go in.
Right, except that I think this is a little bit different because I don't think that there's any question that what is happening in eastern Ukraine is horrible. It is. It's a battle. Civilians are being killed left and right, and this is Europe in 2015.
More than 5,000 people killed.
I mean, this is Europe in the year 2015. Since the end of the Cold War, the mantra has been Europe whole, free, united, and this really puts that into question.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But what about greater sanctions on Russia?
My impression is they are unpopular in Europe, but I think they wouldn't really have much of an effect, domestically on our economy. And the administration has looked to the Iranian sanctions, which they have worked pretty well. The rial dropped in 70% of its value. It's really caused the Iranians to question their economy and get them to the negotiating table. And they looked at that as sort of a model. And there's been targeted sanctions. There could be targeted sanctions on more of those on the Russian elite around Putin.
All right. To Ralph here in Washington, D.C., you're on the air.
Hi, Diane. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
I'm really surprised. I every once in a while I listen. I turn into the Fox News channel for entertainment value, and you know, Yemen revolution is Obama's fault, and the Ukrainian thing is Obama's fault, and you know, they wake up in the morning with hemorrhoids. It's Obama's fault. You know, now they're talking about let's go into Iran, but what they don't tell you is that China said don't do that. And what they said was, Russia said, don't do that. They're 50 miles away. And, you know, the Russians, all they have to do is give them some of those torpedoes that go at 250 miles an hour, and our aircraft carriers are in the bottom of the ocean. Or they just hand them some tactical nukes. I mean, you know, the system is so screwed up that the top 1% are now getting 90% of the wealth. And I think we should have a draft. I think we should draft the children of the top 1%. They're getting 90% of the wealth. They should carry 90% of the military.
On the beginning point about everything being the fault of the administration, I do tend to think that there is, particularly within inside the Beltway in this kind of echo chamber, a lot of overstated opinions about how everything that goes wrong in the world is the fault of the United States, whoever the administration is that's in power, whether it was the Bush administration or whether it's this administration, or, you know, going back to the, you know, Fillmore administration, for that matter. It is true that not everything in the world is the fault of the United States. Everything bad in the world is not the fault of the United States. That said, there is always room for improvement in foreign policy. And there's a lot that this administration, as others, can be criticized for fairly in foreign policy.
I think that there are some parallels between the debate over arming Ukrainian forces and arming the rebels in Syria, because both of those situations are just these protracted no-win no-good option situations where the Obama administration has obviously deliberated and deliberated, not been able to come to an agreement to do either of these things yet. But I think that there are fair questions that are holding them back, which are that, you know, just doing something doesn't make it the right thing to do. And obviously that's the line of the people in the administration are holding them back.
Last word, Peter.
I would just say the clock is always not at 1938. You know, this isn't necessarily the invasion of Sudetenland. Things are different.
Peter Bergen of CNN, Mitzi Ryan of The Washington Post, Matthew Lee of The Associated Press. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody.
Likewise. Happy Friday the 13th.
Thank you, and thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Susan Casey, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Danielle Knight, Allison Brody, and Alexandra Boti. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev-Lifker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.